The cement road was smooth, and he drove at the roadrunner's top speed of 60 kilometers per hour. He could just feel the rush of thin air against his faceplate. All that CO2 that Sachs so wanted to scrub from the atmosphere. Sachs would need powerful scrubbers, even more powerful than the lichens. He needed forests, enormous, multi-layered halophilic rainforests, trapping enormous loads of carbon in wood, leaves, mulch, peat. He needed peat bogs 100 meters deep, rainforests 100 meters tall. He had said as much. It marked Anne's face just to hear the sound of his voice. 15 minutes drive, and they came to Nadia's arcade. The site was still under construction and looked raw and messy, like Underhill in the beginning, but on a larger scale. A long mound of burgundy rubble had been excavated from the trench, which ran east and west like Big Man's grave. They stood at one end of the great trench, 30 meters deep, 30 wide, 1 kilometer long. The south side of the trench was now a wall of glass, and the north side of the trench was covered with arrays of filtering mirrors, alternating with wall mesocosms. Mars jars or terrariums, all of them together a colorful mix, like a tapestry of past and future. Most of the terrariums were filled with spruce trees and other flora that made it resemble the great world-wrapping Terran forest of the 60th latitude. Like Nadia Chernyshevsky's old home in Siberia, in other words. Was this perhaps a sign that she had a touch of his disease? And could he prevail on her to build a Mediterranean? Nadia was up working on a bulldozer. A woman with her own kind of viriditas. She stopped and came over to talk briefly with them. The project was coming along, she told them calmly. Amazing what one could do with the robot vehicles that were still being sent up from Earth. The concourse was done and planted with a variety of trees, including a strain of dwarf sequoia already 30 meters tall, nearly as tall as the whole arcade. The three stacked rows of Underhill-style vaulted chambers behind the concourse were installed, their insulation in place. The settlement had just the other day been sealed and heated and pressurized so that it was possible to work inside it without suits. The three floors were stacked on each other in ever smaller arches, reminding Michel of the Pont du Gard. Of course, all the architecture here was Roman in origin, so that shouldn't be a surprise. The arches were wider, however, and slighter, airier in the tolerance of the G. Nadia went back to work. Such a calm person. Stable, the very opposite of Label. Low-keyed, private, inward. Couldn't be less like her old friend Maya. It was good for Maya to be around her. Opposite end of the scale, keep her from flying away, set an example for her. As in this encounter where Maya was matching Nadia's calm tone, and when Nadia went back to work, Maya retained some of that serenity. I'll miss Underhill when we move out here, she said. Won't you? I don't think so, Michel said. This will be a lot sunnier. All three floors of the new habitat would open onto the tall concourse and have terraced broad balconies on the sunny side of the rooms, so that even though the whole structure faced north and was buried deeper than Underhill, the heliotropic filtered mirrors on the other side of the trench would pour light onto them from dawn to dusk. I'll be happy to move. We've needed the space from the beginning. But we won't get all this space to ourselves. There'll be new people here. Yes, but that will give us space of a different kind. She looked thoughtful. Like John and Frank leaving. Yes, but even that isn't necessarily a bad thing. In a larger society, he told her, the claustrophobic village atmosphere of Underhill would begin to dissipate. This would give a better perspective on certain aspects of things. Michelle hesitated before continuing, unsure how to say it. Subtlety was dangerous when you were both using a second language, coming at it from different native tongues. Possibilities for misunderstanding were all too real. You must accept the idea that you perhaps do not want to choose between John and Frank, that in fact you want them both. In the context of the first 100, that can only be scandalous, but in a larger world, over time...
Hiroko keeps 10 men, she exclaimed angrily.
Yes, and so do you. So do you. And in a larger world, no one will know or care. He went on reassuring her, telling her that she was powerful, that, using Frank's terms, she was the alpha female of the troop. She disagreed and forced more praise from him until finally she was satiated and he could suggest they return home. "Don't you think it will be a shock to have new people around, different people?" She was driving, and as she turned to ask him this, she almost drove off the road. "I suppose." Parties had already landed in Borealis and Acidalia, and the videotapes of them had been a shock. You could see it in people's faces, as if aliens had arrived from space. But so far, only Anne and Simon had met with any of them in person, running into a rover expedition north of Noctis Labyrinthus. Anne said it felt as if someone had stepped out of the TV.
"My life feels like that all the time," Maya said sadly.
Michelle lifted his eyebrows. The Maya program would not have said that. "What do you mean?"
"Oh, you know, half the time it seems like one big simulation, don't you think?"
"No," he considered it. "I don't." It was all too real, in fact. The cold of it seeping up through the rover's seat deep into his flesh, inescapably real, inescapably cold. Perhaps as a Russian she didn't appreciate that, but it was always, always cold, even at noon on Midsummer's Day, with the sun overhead like an open furnace door blazing in the sand-colored sky, the temperature would be at best 260 degrees Kelvin, meaning 15 degrees below zero centigrade, cold enough to push through the mesh of a walker and make each move a little diamond pattern of hurt. As they approached Underhill, Michelle felt the cold pushing through the fabric into his skin, and he felt the too cool oxygenated air expand out of the mouthpiece deep into his lungs, and he glanced up at the sand horizon and the sand sky and said to himself, "I am a diamondback snake, slithering through a red desert of cold stone and dry dust. Someday I will shed my skin like a phoenix in a fire to become some new creature of the sun, to walk the beach naked and splash in warm salt water." Back at Underhill, he turned on the shrink program in his head and asked Maya if she was feeling better, and she touched her faceplate to his, giving him a brief glimpse of a gaze that was a kiss.
"You know I do," her voice said in his ear.
He nodded. "I think I'll go for another walk, then," he said, and did not say, "But what about me? What will make me feel better?" He willed the movement of his legs and walked off. The bleak plain surrounding the base was a vision out of some post-Holocaust desolation, a nightmare world. Nevertheless, he didn't want to go back into their little warren of artificial light and heated air and carefully deployed colors, colors that he himself had chosen for the most part, utilizing the very latest in color mood theory, a theory which he now understood to be based on certain root assumptions that didn't in fact apply here. The colors were all wrong, or worse, irrelevant. Wallpaper in hell. The phrase formed in his mind and pushed at his lips. Wallpaper in hell. Wallpaper in hell. Since they're going to go crazy anyway, certainly it had been a mistake to have only one psychiatrist along. Every therapist on Earth was also in therapy. It was part of the job. It came with the territory. But his therapist was back in Nice, 15 time-slipped minutes away at best, and Michelle talked to him, but he couldn't help. He didn't understand, not really. He lived where it was warm and blue. He could go outside. He was, Michelle presumed, in reasonably good mental health. While Michelle was a doctor in a hospice in a prison in hell, and the doctor was sick. He hadn't been able to adapt. People were different in that regard. It was a matter of temperament. Maya, walking toward the locked door, had a temperament quite different from his, which somehow enabled her to be completely at home here. To tell the truth, he didn't think she really noticed her surroundings much in any case, and yet in other ways he and she were similar,
It had to do with the lability stability index and its particular emotionality. They were both label. And yet, fundamentally, they were very different characters. The label stable index had to be considered in combination with the very different set of characteristics grouped under the labels extroversion and introversion. This had been his great discovery of the recent year, and now it structured all his thinking about himself and his charges. Walking toward the alchemist's quarter, he fit the morning's events into the gridwork of this new characterological system. Extroversion-introversion was one of the best-studied systems of traits in all psychological theory, with great masses of evidence from many different cultures supporting the objective reality of the concept. Not as a simple duality, of course. One didn't label a person plainly this or that, but rather place them on a scale, rating them for such qualities as sociability, impulsiveness, changeability, talkativeness, outgoingness, activity, liveliness, excitability, optimism, and so on. These measurements had been done so many times that it was statistically certain that the various traits did indeed hang together, to a degree that exceeded chance by a huge amount. So the concept was real, quite real. In fact, physiological investigations had revealed that extroversion was linked with resting states of low cortical arousal, introversion with high cortical arousal. This had sounded backward to Michel at first, but then he remembered that the cortex inhibits the lower centers of the brain, so that low cortical arousal allows the more uninhibited behavior of the extrovert, while high cortical arousal is inhibitory and leads to introversion. This explained why drinking alcohol, a depressant which lowers cortical arousal, could lead to more excited and uninhibited behavior. So the whole collection of extrovert-introvert traits, with all that they said about one's character, could be traced back to a group of cells in the brainstem called the ascending reticular activating system, the area that ultimately determined levels of cortical arousal. Thus, they were driven by biology. There should be no such thing as fate. Ralph Waldo Emerson, a year after his 6-year-old son died. But biology was fate. And there was more to Michel's system. Fate, after all, was no simple either-or. He had recently begun to consider Wenger's index of autonomic balance, which used 7 different variables to determine whether an individual was dominated by the sympathetic or the parasympathetic branches of the autonomic nervous system. The sympathetic branch responds to outside stimuli and alerts the organism to action so that individuals dominated by this branch were excitable. The parasympathetic branch, on the other hand, habituates the alerted organism to the stimulus and restores it to homeostatic balance so that individuals dominated by this branch were placid. Duffy had suggested calling these 2 classes of individuals labels and stables, and this classification, while not as famous as extroversion and introversion, was just as solidly backed by empirical evidence and just as useful in understanding varieties of temperament. Now, neither system of classification told the investigator all that much about the total nature of the personality being studied. The terms were so general. They were collections of so many traits that they said very little in any useful diagnostic sense, especially since both were Gaussian curves in the actual population. But combine the 2 systems, and it began to get very interesting indeed. It was not a simple matter, and Michel had spent a fair amount of time at his computer screen sketching one kind of combinatoire after another, using the 2 different systems as the X and Y axes of several different grids, none of which told him much. But then he began moving the 4 terms around the initial points of a grimace semantic rectangle, a structuralist schema with alchemical ancestry, which proposed that no simple dialectic was enough to indicate the true complexity of any cluster of related concepts, so that it was necessary to acknowledge the real difference between something's opposite and its contrary, the concept not X being not quite the same thing as anti-X, as one saw immediately. So the first stage was usually indicated by using the 4 terms S, not S, anti-S, and anti-not S in a simple rectangle. The next step in the complication of the design, the step where new combinations often revealed structural relationships not at all obvious on the face of it, was to build another rectangle that bracketed the first at right angles. And Michel had stared at this schema, with extroversion, introversion, lability, and stability at the first four corners, and considered their combinations. Suddenly, everything had fallen into focus, as if a kaleidoscope had clicked by accident into a depiction of a rose, for it made perfect sense. There were extroverts who were excitable, and extroverts who were on an even keel. There were introverts who were quite emotional, and those who were not. He could immediately think of examples among the four colonists of all four of the types. When considering names to give these combined categories, he had had to laugh. Unbelievable! It was ironic at best to think that he had used the results of a century's psychological thinking and some of the latest laboratory research in psychophysiology, not to mention a complicated apparatus from structuralist alchemy, all in order to reinvent the ancient system of the humors. But there it was. That was what it came down to. For the northern combination, extroverted and stable, was clearly what Hippocrates, Galen, Aristotle, Trismegistus, Wundt, and Jung would have called sanguine. The western point, extroverted and label, was choleric. In the east, introverted and stable was phlegmatic, and in the south, introverted and label was, of course, the very definition of the melancholic. Yes, they all fit perfectly. Galen's physiological explanation for the four temperaments had been wrong, of course, and bile, choler, blood, and phlegm had now been replaced as causative agents by the ascending reticular activating system and the autonomic nervous system. But the truths of human nature had held fast. And the powers of psychological insight and analytic logic of the first Greek physicians had been as strong, or rather stronger by far, than that of any subsequent generations, blinkered by an often useless accumulation of knowledge. And so the categories had endured and were reaffirmed in age after age. Michel found himself in the alchemist's quarter. He exerted himself to pay attention to it. Here men used arcane knowledge to make diamonds out of carbon, and they made it so easily and precisely that all their window glass was coated in a molecular layer of diamond to protect it from the corrosive dust. Their great white salt pyramids, one of the great shapes of ancient knowledge, the pyramid, were coated in layers of pure diamond. And the one-molecule diamond-coating process was just one of thousands of alchemical operations performed in these squat buildings. In recent years, the buildings had taken on a faintly Muslim look, their white brick walls displaying equation after equation, all rendered in black, flowing mosaic calligraphy. Michel ran into Sachs, who was standing next to the terminal velocity equation displayed on the wall of the brick factory, and he switched to the common band. "Can you turn lead into gold?" Sachs's helmet tilted quizzically. "Why, no," he said. "Those are elements. It would be hard. Let me think about it some." Saxifrage Russell, the perfect phlegmatic. The really useful part of mapping the four temperaments onto the semantic rectangle was that it immediately suggested a number of basic structural relationships between them, which then helped Michel to see their attractions and antagonisms in a new light. Maya was label and extroverted, clearly choleric, and so was Frank. And both of them were leaders, and both were quite attracted to the other. Both being choleric, however, there was a volatile and essentially repellent aspect to the relationship as well, as if they recognized in each other exactly what they didn't like in themselves. And thus Maya's love for John, who was clearly sanguine, with an extroversion similar to Maya's but much more emotionally stable, even to the point of placidity. So that most of the time he gave her great peace, like an anchor to reality,
which then occasionally rankled. And John's attraction to Maya? The attraction of the unpredictable, perhaps. The spice in his hearty, bland happiness. Sure, why not? You can't make love to your fame, even though some people try. Yes, there were a lot of sanguines in the first 100. Probably the psychological specs for selection to the colony preferred the type. Arcady, Ursula, Phyllis, Spencer, Yelly. Yes. And stability being the most preferred quality for selection, there were naturally a lot of phlegmatics among them as well. Nadia, Sack, Simon Fraser, perhaps Hiroko. The fact that one couldn't even be sure about her tended to support the guess. Vlad, George, Alex. Phlegmatics and melancholics would naturally not get along, both being introverted and quick to withdraw, and the stable one put off by the unpredictability of the label, so that they would withdraw from each other, like Sax and Anne. There weren't many melancholics among them. Anne, yes, and probably by the fate of her brain structure, although it didn't help that she had been mistreated as a child. She had fallen in love with Mars for the same reason that Michelle hated it, because it was dead, and Anne was in love with death. A few of the alchemists were melancholics as well, and, unfortunately, Michelle himself, perhaps 5 all told. Along both axes they had been selected against, as neither introversion nor lability had been considered desirable by the selection committee. Only people quite clever at concealing their real nature from the committee could have slipped through, people with great control over their personas, those larger-than-life masks that conceal all the wild inconsistencies within. Perhaps only a certain kind of persona had been selected to the colony, with a wide variety of persons behind it. Was that true? The selection committees had made impossible demands. It was important to remember that. They had wanted stables, and yet they had wanted people who cared about going to Mars so passionately and monomaniacally that they would devote years of their lives to achieving the goal. Was that consistent? They wanted extroverts, and they wanted brilliant scientists who necessarily had had to dive deep into solitary study for years and years. Was that consistent? No, never. It went on like that all down the list. They had created double bind after double bind. No wonder the first 100 had hidden from them, had hated them. He recalled with a shudder that moment in the great solar storm on the Ares when everyone had realized how much lying and hiding they had had to do, when they had all turned and stared at him with all that pent-up fury, as if it were all his fault, as if he were all psychology and had concocted the criteria and conducted the tests and made the selections all by himself. How he had cringed at that moment, how alone he had felt. It had shocked him, frightened him, so much that he hadn't been able to think fast enough to confess that he, too, had lied. Of course he had, more than any of the rest of them. But why had he lied? Why? This was what he couldn't quite recall. Melancholia as a failure of memory, an acute sensation of the irreality of the past, its non-existence. He was a melancholic, withdrawn, out of control of his feelings, inclined to depression. He shouldn't have been chosen to go, and now he could not remember why he had fought so passionately to be chosen. The memory had gone away, overwhelmed perhaps by the poignant, aching, fragmented images of the life he had lived in the interstices of his desire to go to Mars, so minuscule and so precious. The evenings in the plazas, the summer days on the beaches, the nights in women's beds, the olive trees of Avignon, the green flame cypress. He found he had left the alchemist's quarter. He was at the foot of the Great Salt Pyramid. He stepped slowly up the 400 stairs, putting his feet carefully on the blue no-slip pads. Each step gave him a wider view of Underhill Plain, but it was still the same sere and barren rock pile, no matter how large it got.
From the square white pavilion at the pyramid's summit, one could just see Chernobyl and the spaceport. Other than that, nothing. Why had he come to this place? Why had he worked so hard to get here, sacrificing so many of the pleasures of life, family, home, leisure, play? He shook his head. So far as he could recall, it had simply been what he had wanted to do, the definition of his life, a compulsion, a life with a goal. How could you tell the difference? Moonlit nights in the fragrant olive grove, the ground dotted with small black circles, and the electric warm brush of the Mistral rustling the leaves in quick soft waves, flat on his back, arms spread wide, the leaves flickering silver and gray under the black bowl of stars. And one of those stars would be steady, faint, red, and he would seek it out and watch it, there among the wind-swept olive leaves. And he had been 8 years old. My God! What were they? Nothing explained that. Nothing explained them. As well explain why they had painted in Lascaux, why they had built stone cathedrals into the sky, why coral polyps built reefs. He had had an ordinary youth, moved often, lost what friends he made, went to the University of Paris to study psychology, did his degree work on space station depression, and went to work for Ariane and then Glove Cosmos. Along the way, got married and divorced. Françoise had said he was not there. All those nights with her in Avignon, all those days in Villefranche-sur-Mer, living in the most beautiful place on earth, and he had walked about in a fog of desire for Mars. It was absurd. Worse, it was stupid. A failure of the imagination, of memory, of, finally, intelligence itself. He had not been able to see what he had had, or to imagine what he would get. And now he was paying for it, trapped on an ice floe in the Arctic night with 99 foreigners, not one of whom spoke French worth a damn. Only three who could even try, and Frank's French was worse than no French at all, like listening to someone attack the language with a hatchet. The absence of his mind's own tongue had driven him to watching TV from home, which only exacerbated his pain. Still, he taped video monologues and sent them to his mother and sisters so that they would send replies in kind. He watched the replies many times, looking more at the backdrops than at his relatives. He even had occasional live conversations with journalists, waiting impatiently between exchanges. Those talks made it clear how famous he was in France, a household name, and he was careful to answer everything conventionally, playing the Michel Duval persona, running the Michel program. Sometimes he canceled consultations with fellow colonists when he was in the mood to listen to French. Let them eat English. But these incidents got him a sharp reprimand from Frank and a conference with Maya. Was he overworked? Of course not. Only 99 people to keep sane, while at the same time wandering in a Provence of the mind, on tree-covered steep hillsides with their vineyards and farmhouses and ruined towers and monasteries, in a living landscape, a landscape infinitely more beautiful and humane than the stony waste of this reality. He was in the TV lounge. While lost in thought, he had apparently gone back inside, but he couldn't remember that. He had thought he was still standing on top of the Great Pyramid, and then he had blinked and was in the TV lounge, all asylums have them, watching a video image of one of the lichen-covered canyon walls of Marineris. He shivered. It had happened again. He had lost touch, gone away and come to later in the day. It had happened already some dozen times before. And it wasn't just being lost in thought, but buried in it, dead to the world. He looked around the room, shivered convulsively. It was LS5 now, the beginning of northern spring, and the northern walls of the Great Canyons were basking in the sun, since they're all going to go crazy anyway. Then it was LS157. And 152 degrees had passed in a blur of tele-existence. He was basking in the sun in the courtyard of Françoise's seaside villa in Villefranche-sur-Mer, looking down on tile rooftops and terracotta pillars and a small pool, turquoise above the cobalt of the Mediterranean. A cypress stood like a green flame over the pool, swaying in a breeze and casting its perfume over his face. In the distance, the green headland of a peninsula. Except really, he was in Underhill Prime, usually called the Trench or Nadia's Arcade, sitting on the upper balcony looking out at a dwarf sequoia. Behind it, the glass wall and the mirrors with their gradient refractive index that guided the light down into the concourse from its origin on the Côte d'Or. Tatiana Durova had been killed by a crane tipped by a robot, and Nadia was inconsolable. But grief runs off us, Michel thought as he sat with her, like rain off a duck. In time, Nadia would be well. Meanwhile, there was nothing to be done. Did they think he was a sorcerer? A priest? If that were true, he would have healed himself, healed all this world, or better, flown through space, home. Wouldn't that cause a sensation, to appear on the beach at Antibes and say, "Bonjour, I am Michel, I have come home." Then it was LS-190, and he was a lizard on the top of the Pont de Gare, on the narrow rectangular rock plates that covered the actual aqueduct itself, which ran in its straight line high over the gorge. His diamond-back skin had sloughed off around his tail, and the hot sun burned the new skin in crisscross lines. Except he was in Underhill, in fact in the atrium, and Frank had gone off to live with the Japanese that had landed in Argyre, and Maya and John were at loggerheads about their rooms and where to house the Unoma local headquarters. And Maya, more beautiful than ever, stalked him through the atrium, imploring his aid. He and Marina Takarova had stopped rooming together nearly a full Martian year before. She had said he wasn't there. And looking at Maya, Michel found himself imagining her as a lover. But of course, this was crazy. She was a Rusalka. She had slept with Glavkosmos bosses and cosmonauts to make her way up through the system, and it had made her dissociated and bitter and unpredictable. She used sex to hurt now. Sex was just diplomacy by other means to her. It would be insane to have anything to do with her in that mode, to be drawn down into the vortex of her limbs and her limbic system. Why not send crazy people in the first place? But now it was LS-241. He walked over the honeycombed limestone parapet of Les Baux, looking in the ruined chambers of the medieval hermitage. It was near sunset, and the light was a curious Martian orange, the limestone glowing, the whole village and hazy plain below stretching out to the white bronze line of the Mediterranean, looking as implausible as a dream. Except it was a dream, and he woke up, and he found himself awake and back in Underhill. Phyllis and Edvard had just returned from an expedition, and Phyllis was laughing and showing them a buttery lump of rock. "It was scattered all over the canyon," she said, laughing. "Gold nuggets the size of your fist." Then he was walking the tunnels out to the garage, the colony's psychiatrist, experiencing visions, falling into gaps of consciousness, gaps of memory. "Physician, heal thyself." But he couldn't. He had gone insane of homesickness. Homesickness. There must be a better term for that, a scientific label that would legitimize it, make it real to others. But he already knew it was real. He missed Provence so much that at times he felt he couldn't breathe. He was like Nadia's hand, a part of it torn away, the ghost nerves still throbbing with pain. And save them the trouble? Time passed. The Michel program walked around, a hollow persona, empty inside, only some tiny homunculus of the cerebellum left to teleoperate the thing. The night of the second day of LS-266, he went to bed.
He was dog-tired, though he had done nothing, totally exhausted and drained, and yet he lay in the dark of his room and couldn't sleep. His mind spun miserably. He was very aware of how sick he was. He wished he could quit the pretense and admit that he had lost it, institutionalize himself, go home. He could remember almost nothing of the previous few weeks, or maybe it was longer than that. He wasn't sure. He began to weep. His door clicked. It swung open, and a narrow wedge of hall light shone in, unblocked. No one there. "Hello?" he said, working to keep the tears out of his voice. "Who is it?" The reply was right in his ear, as if from a helmet intercom. "Come with me," a man's voice said. Michelle jerked back and bumped into the wall. He stared up at a black silhouetted figure. "We need your help," the figure whispered. A hand gripped his arm as he pressed back into the wall. "And you need ours." A suggestion of a smile in the voice, which Michelle did not recognize. Fear thrust him into a new world. Suddenly he could see much better, as if the touch of his visitor had sprung his pupils open like camera apertures. A thin, dark-skinned man. A stranger. Astonishment launched through his fear, and he got up and moved through the dark light with dreamlike precision, stepping into slippers and then, at the stranger's urging, following him out into the hallway, feeling the lightness of Martian G for the first time in years. The hallway seemed bursting with gray light, though he could tell that only the night strips in the floor were on. It was enough to see well by if you were scared. His companion had short, black dreadlocks, which made his head appear spiked. He was short, thin, narrow-faced. A stranger, no doubt about it. An intruder from one of the new colonies in the southern hemisphere, Michelle thought. But the man was leading him through Underhill with an expert touch, moving in utter silence. Indeed, the whole of Underhill was soundless, as if it were a silent black-and-white film. He glanced at his wrist pad. It was blank. The time slip. He wanted to say, "Who are you?" but the silence was so blanketing that he couldn't bring himself to speak. He mouthed the words, and the man turned and looked over his shoulder at him, the whites of his eyes visible and luminous all the way around the irises, the nostrils wide black holes. "I am the stowaway," he mouthed, and grinned. His eye teeth were discolored. They were made of stone, Michelle suddenly saw that. Martian stone teeth in his head. He took Michelle by the arm. They were heading to the farm lock. "We need helmets out there," Michelle whispered, balking. "Not tonight." The man opened the lock door, and no air rushed into it, even though it was open on the other side. They went in and walked between the black rows of packed foliage, and the air was sweet. "Hiroko will be angry," Michelle thought. His guide was gone. Ahead, Michelle saw movement and heard a tinkly little laugh. It sounded like a child. Suddenly, it occurred to Michelle that the absence of children accounted for the colony's pervasive feeling of sterility, that they could build buildings and grow plants, and yet without children, this sterile feeling would still permeate every part of their lives. Extremely frightened, he continued to walk toward the center of the farm. It was warm and humid, and the air stank of wet dirt and fertilizer and foliage. Light glinted from thousands of leaf surfaces, as if the stars had fallen through the clear roof and clustered around him. Rows of corn rustled, and the air was going to his head like brandy. Little feet were scurrying behind the narrow rice paddies. Even in the darkness, the rice was an intense blackish green. And there among the paddies were small faces, grinning knee-high and disappearing when he turned to face them. Hot blood flooded his face and hands, his blood turned to fire, and he retreated 3 steps, then stopped and spun. 2 naked little girls were walking down the lane toward him, black-haired, dark-skinned, about 3 years old. Their oriental eyes were bright in the gloom, their expressions solemn. They took him by the hands and turned him around. He allowed them to lead him down the lane, looking down at first one head and then the other. Someone had decided to take action against their sterility. As they walked along, other naked toddlers appeared out of the shrubbery and crowded around them, boys and girls both, some a bit darker or lighter than the first two, most the same color, all the same age. 9 or 10 of them escorted Michel to the center of the farm, weaving around him in a quick trot. And there at the center of the maze was a small clearing, currently occupied by about 12 adults, all naked, seated in a rough circle. The children ran to the adults, gave them hugs, and sat at their knees. Michel's pupils opened further in the nimbus of starlight and leaf gleam, and he recognized members of the farm team. Ewao, Raoul, Ellen, Raya, Jean, Evgenia, all of the farm team except for Hiroko herself. After a moment's hesitation, Michel stepped out of his slippers and took off his clothes and put them on top of the slippers and sat down in an empty spot in the circle. He didn't know what he was taking part in, but it didn't matter. Several of the figures nodded at him in welcome, and Ellen and Evgenia, seated on each side of him, touched him on the arms. All of a sudden the children got up and ran together down one of the aisles, squealing and giggling. They came back in a tight knot around Hiroko, who walked into the middle of the circle, her naked form dark in the darkness. Trailed by the kids, she walked slowly around the circle, pouring from her two outstretched fists a little bit of dirt into each person's offered hands. Michel held up his palms with Ellen and Evgenia as she approached. He stared at her lustrous skin. Once, on the night beach at Villefranche, he had walked by a gang of African women splashing in the phosphorescent waves, white water on black, gleaming skin. The dirt in his hand was warm and smelled rusty. "This is our body," Hiroko said. She walked to the other side of the circle, gave the children each a fistful of dirt, and sent them back to sit among the adults. She sat across from Michel and began to chant in Japanese. Evgenia leaned over and whispered a translation, or rather an explanation, in his ear. They were celebrating the Areophany, a ceremony they had created together under Hiroko's guidance and inspiration. It was a kind of landscape religion, a consciousness of Mars as a physical space suffused with kami, which was the spiritual energy or power that rested in the land itself. Kami was manifested most obviously in certain extraordinary objects in the landscape. Stone pillars, isolated ejecta, sheer cliffs, oddly smoothed crater interiors, the broad circular peaks of the great volcanoes. These intensified expressions of Mars's kami had a Terran analog within the colonists themselves, the power that Hiroko called Viriditas, that greening fructiparous power within which knows that the wild world itself is holy. Kami. Viriditas. It was the combination of these sacred powers that would allow humans to exist here in a meaningful way. When Michel heard Evgenia whisper the word combination, all the terms immediately fell into a semantic rectangle. Kami and Viriditas, Mars and Earth, hatred and love, absence and yearning. And then the kaleidoscope clicked home, and all the rectangles folded into place in his mind. All antinomies collapsed to a single beautiful rose, the heart of the Areophany. Kami suffused with Viriditas, both fully red and fully green at one and the same time. His jaw was slack, his skin burning. He couldn't explain it and didn't want to. His blood was fire in his veins.